Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, on September 29th, 2010, broadcasting live from the Women in Periodical Publishing Conference, where I just finished speaking, I am delighted to welcome featured guest Stowe Boyd, international authority on social tools, futurist, and much more. Welcome, Stowe.
Hello.
Hey. Thank you, even though your son just walked in the door and you had to tell him you were doing this interview.
Yeah, that's sort of funny.
Yeah, I feel terrible pulling families apart with every podcast. No, that's not the goal. Anyway, obviously you're a huge name. I have yet to actually meet you, which is kind of rare for the folks that I've had on the show, but I wanted to start with the concept of, obviously, social tools are talked about a lot these days, and you've been on the forefront for a very long time talking about them. So with that said, I'm curious to see to gain your perspective on how you think they're defined today and kind of your perspective over time of how people have perceived them.
Well, I think, generally the notion of social tools has at least for the last 5 years, been a very, very much a part of the current work on the web and people's perception of what the web is all about. So at least for the last 5 years, that's been pretty consistent. And basically, the notion boils down to, social technologies, applications that enable people to interact in a rich way on the web. When I first coined the term in 99, I said they were tools not designed to primarily work on making communication more efficient or crunching numbers, but were intended to shape culture. Now, when I did that in 99, a lot of people thought I was a little over the edge. But today, after we've had a decade of experience, it's clear that that's exactly what is happening, starting with things like social media, blogging, and so on. And now I think significantly more obvious when you look at things like social networking apps like Twitter and Facebook, for example.
So when you think of social tools, one of the things that I even talked about at this conference is I tend to think that there's sort of two schools of thought. One is, obviously social tools, people like, Stefania Broadbent, who has a video that everybody seemed to see about, social networking, but really it's the social tools that allow us to interact, maybe have more authentic or in her work, intimate conversations with one another or interactions with one another without necessarily being in person. And then there's the other side where it's sort of the marketing and monetization part, where there's, do we want to include features that are social tools, or do we really want to bake this into a community concept? Where have you sat on this? I mean, are you looking at it more from a business perspective, a social perspective, or both?
Well, I guess I consider myself a webthropologist, so I'm more or less looking at the whole thing from an anthropological viewpoint. That is, here's the interesting things that people are doing. What are these affordances that are being offered by these tools that make it possible? And how is it that people respond on an individual basis, collectively in groups or as a society? And then obviously the impact it has on things like media and business is very important. So one aspect of it, and it's only one aspect of it, a very interesting one, is how will businesses adapt to thinking about and using social tools, including social media, but also the whole spectrum of social tools to increase the likelihood of their success, right, to help them prosper and innovate in a changing time. And, of course, the changing time that the businesses are trying to survive in or thrive in includes a world where a lot of social goings-on are happening now on the web. So, some of it is sort of an inevitability. This is the way the world is going. And for businesses, some of it isn't an inevitability, right? They can continue to think about social tools as merely a way to interact with potential markets, or they can move past that and start thinking about how they might use it internally to innovate, to devise and roll out better products to have a more efficient and productive supply chain, and so on and so forth. And in fact, I think that area is enormously interesting. In fact, I'm doing a conference in April on the topic of social business because I think it's obvious that it's necessary, and companies are trying to do these things. They're moving in that direction, and so one of my goals has been for that conference is to sort of create a place where people that are interested in this, people that have been tasked inside of large corporations, for example, with looking into this, we can have a community and we'll start coming together on a regular basis so people can share perceptions and thoughts and goals and they can hear people's, war stories about what they're doing. So I think that area is very interesting, but it's only one part of the greater society that's being changed by these tools. And I think it's just as interesting to talk about what happens with individuals or, personal relationships, as well as, how this intrudes into the sort of business sector. They're both interesting, and they're mutually reinforcing.
Absolutely. And certainly, we should call out the conference you're speaking of, which is Social Business Edge, am I right, with Jeff Pulver?
Right. April 19th in New York City.
And it's EdgeWards, right? Is that's the URL, EdgeWards.com?
Yeah, EdgeWards.com/social business.
Okay. So I think I think we actually already have a link on my website for that, but we'll make sure that there's a link there. I think that one of the interesting points you make about innovation is something that I ponder all the time about, are we really pushing the envelope, or are we spending a lot of time, maybe too much time, discussing maybe what we already know or things that you could find on the web. So I thought of an example of kind of something that a lot of people talked about when I was at the LaWeb conference in December, which was Pearl Trees, which is a company that you probably are very aware of, and it segues nicely into another part of your work, which is the Internet Archive Initiative. And Pearl Trees claims that it's trying to be another application that can help folks archive the web. And for those of us that have been doing this for a really long time, and I remember 1999, I was working in a web business then, we know the value of things, applications and tools and innovation that helps us preserve our history, because it does move so quickly. And I'm just curious your thoughts on sort of innovation in that area, maybe that particular product, if you're aware of it, and kind of what you're doing at the Internet Archive, why archiving is important.
Well, the Internet Archive, has a very, very large scale, large bore goal, which is basically archiving the web. And with the intention of, guaranteeing that things that you're looking for, if the website goes away in the future, you can still find it, more or less, right? So that's the goal of the Internet Archive. I've gotten involved with the Internet Archive on a very specific project that's, clearly supporting the overall charter of the archive, but it's very specific to, a wrinkle in the new real-time web that we're involved in, and that is the creation of URLs that are short, shortening of URLs.
Yeah.
And, of course, the notion that, there are companies out there that will shorten a URL and then, translate it into the long one later on when people would, click on it, it's fine as long as they're still in existence. But starting in the spring of last year, people started to several URL shortening companies were talking about going out of business, and it caused a lot of concern in the web in general, because all of a sudden, if you can't rely on these short URLs, my God, what a pain it is to try to clean up a mess where you might have used short URLs throughout your website, or you've got them embedded in your blog, or you're just sharing stuff with friends through Twitter or something. And so a group of companies got together and decided to figure out a way to backstop that, and ultimately led to a project that I'm now the director of called 301 Works, that is an Internet Archive initiative. And we've got something like 35 or 40 companies. I don't remember the exact number right now. People are signing up every day, literally. And the intention of that is if a company decides that later on they want to go out of business and they want to do it in a graceful way, they can hand over their database of short and long URLs, and the Internet Archives 301 Works project will, you know, serve up those mappings to people, even though the company is now out of business. So that's basically what we're doing. It's a very narrow bore, you know, solution to a very focused problem. And I got involved in that because of my nonprofit work. I have an organization called microsyntax.org that's supposed to be, you know, a scientific research and educational kind of company, nonprofit, focused on what I call the deep structure of the real-time stream, meaning all these information structures that we're relying on or inventing inside of tools like Twitter and Facebook and so on. And that's one of the projects that we're doing at MicroSyntax right now. There's a couple of others. One is a project called the Open Medical Health Exchange, which is a collection of, you know, what we call microsyntax, you know, the way of encoding information in a structured way, that's designed for transmitting medical information from biomedical machines to either people or other machines. And that's being headed up by a very smart guy named Alan Vyars, and there's a whole bunch of biomedical companies that are getting involved in that initiative. And the newest thing we're doing in microsyntax is a thing called emergency codes, and this has just started up as a result of the current or recent earthquake in Haiti, and it led to a bunch of people thinking about ways to use Twitter as a way of signaling or asking questions about the crisis, you know, inquiring if someone's okay or whether or not somebody could send blankets to this particular hospital or whatever. And so now I'm working with informally, but soon to be a little more formal, I think, with some other organizations like the Project EPIC at University of Colorado. We've been in discussions about coming up with an international, you know, not based on English or French or whatever, kind of emergency code system that we could use in circumstances like that. And so I'm involved in a bunch of those things, you know, and it obviously is a direct consequence of my sort of anthropological interest in these systems, but in a much more directed way. We're trying to do stuff that's good for the community of people using these systems and helping them do it in productive ways.
Yeah, and obviously in very thoughtful ways as well, because obviously, you know, when crises erupt, it tends to be that reactionary, knee-jerk reaction. And what we've seen is even with the text to donate, you know, it was actually Katrina that caused the Red Cross to come up with their texting system to be able to, you know, get funding quickly. And now we're seeing it deployed in Haiti. And we have the First Lady on television telling us donate money that way. It's really interesting to be ahead of the curve that way and hopefully, you know, come up with a good way to, because I think your point about trying to find your loved ones, I mean, I was one of those people who was flown to New York for 9/11, helped cover it, and that was one of the hardest things to try to report on is you can't ignore this human factor that you would feel yourself if a loved one were in a tragedy like that. So I think that's fantastic work, and I think it probably gives you insight into lots of other things.
Well, there's no doubt that, you know, having spent the last, you know, 7 or 8 months or even time before I formed MicroSyntax thinking about, you know, and writing about the emergence of all these information patterns in Twitter and other tools puts me in a good position to help when it comes time to think about how we might do something like emergency codes. And so, yeah, we're going to try to get a large group of, you know, interested folks together and come up with something that, you know, ultimately, you know, it's my hope anyway that, you know, people like the UN and the Red Cross and FEMA and whoever else could, you know, be aware of, be conversant with, and promulgate when there's another tsunami or earthquake or hurricane. And,
or I can even think of other, you know, there are other, you know, I mean, I was, as a Peace Corps volunteer, I can think of, you know, my mom being so paranoid that, you know, something, some large event would happen that would be off her radar because the U.S. press is so focused on the U.S., and she would have no way of knowing. It's like you can imagine ways where you could take technology like this to almost, you know, put in a picture of someone, and then if a news story came up and that person's face were there, or something like it, you know, it could signal you in some way. Just to kind
well,
of think.
Yeah, certainly it's the case. And one of the things we want to do is to develop some open source code so that it would make it relatively easy for people to be able to, you know, take the Twitter stream or Facebook or whatever the solution might be and create applications that are specialized for things like that. So if you said, has anyone seen this person? Has this person been identified anywhere? You know, just sending the message out and hoping that somebody will respond in an emergency is a sort of a disastrous outcome because there's so many messages going by, nobody even sees them. What you really want is have an application that would develop a database of all the people that are mentioned in status updates and then do the matching for you. So when you say, has anyone seen this person, you know, and here's her name, it would show it to you that someone, in fact, had said that that person had a broken leg but was in a hospital somewhere and is okay. You don't want to just use the system to hope that somebody will answer you directly when you inquire. You want it to be able to, you know, build an archive of information, and then people could, you know, search against the archive. So for that to work, you have to have, you know, these affordances again. You need to have the app. You need to have the language, you know, this encoding, this what I'm calling emergency codes, in place. And then you have to have people build the apps in advance so
mm-hmm.
that when the emergency happens, everything works.
Absolutely.
So we're hoping with this we'll be able to do something like that and be able to, as a result, you know, and do it in an open source way so that we can actually give that code away and anyone can build applications to do all sorts of things.
So this is super topical, and I'd like to go a little step deeper and play devil's advocate. So recently I moderated a panel for Social Media Club out here in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, and we were talking about privacy. And there were a couple, you know, I asked folks, it was, you know, what's going to happen in 2010, and I asked people, what would you bet on to happen in 2010? And then I said, what keeps you up at night? And more than half the panel, which included Brian Solis and Jeremiah Yang and among others, noted privacy as a major concern. So what I'm wondering is, again, playing devil's advocate to what I think is, you know, a wonderful idea and has such a great, humanitarian purpose, playing devil's advocate, is there a privacy concern? And how do you address it when you're looking at something like, you know, building a database where it has enough information to be useful?
Well, you know, there's questions certainly of privacy as soon as you start to get involved with, you know, sociality at all. You know, as soon as people are interacting in open public networks, then it's obviously possible for people to disclose things that later on or they might have second thoughts of, or other people may be concerned because it implicates them in some way and so on. So there's always that possibility just because it's similar in a way to how we interact in non-online ways. And it's possible to make a wisecrack at a dinner party that's taken the wrong way and you offend people or whatever. It's, you know, so it's possible that offense could be created of some sort, or that information could be disclosed that other people wished wasn't. So that's
mm-hmm.
always possible. The situation, though, is all the information that might be going through a system of this sort for an emergency context might not be about people. I mean, it could be, you know, it could be a hospital wanting to post that they have certain goods that they could share. They have more than they need of something, but at the same time, they need blankets. And there's no, in a sense, there's no personal issue involved with that. It's a organization wanting to be helped. And in an emergency setting, you know, providing that information in an open fashion might be a fast way for it to lead to getting blankets. And so in a very practical basis, a lot of the things that go on in an emergency might be of that sort. However, there is the possibility that somebody could post that they saw, some particular person face down in a creek dead, and it might be painful, for the family to discover it that way. But on the other hand, that's really a call for that particular individual who's doing it. It's not really a function of the system that might be envisioned, or Twitter, or the use of Twitter or another system in an emergency context. It's not the system, in fact, that's deciding to disclose that information. It's a person, it's an individual, or a part of a government or something. And so one of the questions that should be raised and discussed is what sorts of information should be disclosed by who, when, and so forth. There's certainly plenty of room for that discussion. And there's plenty of room for that discussion in a non-emergency setting, too. So it's not, I think when you were having that panel, I'm sure it wasn't there, the concern of those people or the people raising the point of privacy being a big issue for 2010, they weren't thinking solely or maybe not at all about this particular crisis. In fact, I wrote a post a couple of weeks ago. Well, I've been writing a series of posts recently about the shifting nature of privacy on the web. And in fact, I've been using a term now called publicity, to be a parallel term to privacy, because we have private, and from private we get privacy, and we have public, but there is no corresponding term for the notion of how we should be public, and what does it mean to make yourself more public, and what kind of impact is an increasingly public world going to have on things like our notion of self-identity or the social etiquette associated with presenting yourself and interacting in different contexts online. So I think I wrote a post most recently called The Decade of Publicity, arguing that we're going to see an increased amount of our time and energies and our interaction in settings that are increasingly designed around people disclosing or learning or getting involved about certain sorts of things like music or religion or building software. And the reality is, as people spend more and more of their time in that kind of interaction, which is somewhat different than real life, physical interaction with people in closed physical spaces, it's going to change how we perceive the nature of relationships, how people interact, and what is even the notion of a self. So I think that's a very sort of a, at a very philosophical level, it's very important, it's very interesting. It has very serious ramifications for things like the fundamental premises of things we take as rights, for example, in Western society, the right to privacy, for example. Well, what does it mean to have a right to publicity, for example? Someone who's recently writing about the notion that internet access should be an unalienable right, and that if you deprive people of it, that they're so disadvantaged in the modern world that it's like not allowing people to send their kids to school, for example. And we have certain premises in Western civilization, it's not uniform around the world, that certain things should be provided to everyone in a sort of semi, at least reasonably equal way, with the hope that it's as equal as we can make it. And we perceive that it is a failure of our society if, for example, kids don't get a relatively similar education. We worry about the fact that some state, let's say Mississippi or Louisiana, spends less, on their kids' education than other parts of the country, and we think that that's something to be remedied, not just tolerated. But we don't have exactly the same attitude about things like internet access. So increasingly, I think those kinds of issues will all collide. They're all sort of inseparably connected in a way. It's going to have, which is why I said it's a decade in which I characterize it, not that the notion of privacy and the principles of privacy will go away, but increasingly it'll sort of be overshadowed by the notions of increasing public life and public interaction.
Well, one of the things on our panel, I neglected to mention that Beth Cantor, the sort of nonprofit legend that writes Beth's blog, she was on the panel. And myself, I do a lot of pro bono work, so her and I both raised the issue of HIPAA, which is the law that is meant to protect our identities and give us privacy when it comes to medical issues. And I have consulted with a company it's an agency that helps kids in crisis. And I'm increasingly, and this is a question that pertains both to social tools and to, potentially archiving as well and what we've just been discussing. So it's kind of, I think it's really relevant to a lot of areas that you're an expert in. But that is, how do we protect, and especially as you have a project going on in the medical field, how do we protect medical privacy, especially among children? And obviously it's going to be respective of country, but even when there are laws to protect it, a lot of lawmakers either don't understand or don't know how to make provisions for innovations that may create ways to violate that privacy.
Well, I'm not a HIPAA expert by any means, but I believe certainly that governments should enact laws to allow people, to the degree that they want to protect information that could be detrimental to themselves, in particular health information. So, we're in a world where, it's dangerous for individuals to have other people find out that they have health problems because it could lead to them being, dismissed from their work or denied hiring from or denied insurance. I mean, to some extent, that's why we have a movement towards health reform, or I should say health insurance reform in the United States right now is to, in fact, stop insurance companies from being able to deny you coverage because you have a health problem. So if you step far enough back from that, you say, well, the fundamental notion is that therefore as a society what we're saying is people should have access to health care. And we're currently not dealing with the health carriers, we're talking about insurance, but ultimately it's the same thing. So, but if we're in a world where you weren't going to be denied coverage because everyone had universal coverage, then a lot of the reasons for hiding health information would go away. And so that's nice. I mean, that's sort of, from my viewpoint, that's like really addressing the root cause and not the symptom here. The same thing is true in other contexts. So I think it was a few years ago that the Electronic Frontier Foundation suggested that anyone who had a job should blog anonymously, because otherwise there's no guarantee that your employer might not find something you write on your blog objectionable, and they could fire you. And there's really not much you can do about it. And so we have the fundamental thing is that you can be fired basically for almost any reason in America. We don't have employment contracts as a rule, and as a result, people can fire you for one reason and say the reason is something else, and it doesn't have to be, dealt with in a court of law or even a union proceedings, because most people aren't union. So, that seems like a very heavy-handed solution to a very serious issue, which is, do people in the United States have the right to have free and open public opinions about things, and can they express it? And, in principle we do, because we have First Amendment rights that say you can, free speech, you can talk about whatever you want. But the reality is, you don't really have free speech if you can lose your livelihood because you say something that other people don't agree with or think is unpalatable. I mean, even if it's legal what you're proposing, you know, you're not necessarily advocating the overthrow of the U.S. government. But if you, you know, just lean a little bit in the wrong direction, somebody who leans the other way and is your employer, they can fire you. And so I think that's just, you know, that's a horrible truth. And there isn't much you can do about it, except for, you know, having a government that would somehow ensure the rights of individuals to actually have free speech. So we have these problems, and, you know, you can swing all the way to one extreme, like blogging anonymously, or you do what most people do, which is they self-censor. And they don't talk about something they believe deeply that they think might be objectionable to their bosses. I actually did a poll on that on my blog a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
67% of the people who read my blog, who are people who are much more likely to be in favor of free speech and open-mindedness and whatever, 67% agreed with this premise I had hoped they wouldn't agree with, which is if you're an employee of a company and are in one way or another associated with a company, even if you put, you know, the disclaimers on your blog that these are your opinions and not those of your employer, do you think that you can really say whatever you want on your blog? And 67% of the people said, no, you have to censor yourself because you're going to be seen as a, one way or another, as some kind of a representative of the company, and therefore you have to moderate what you say, even if it's against your beliefs. And yikes. So most people think, you know, that there is no real option of having, you know, private free speech as an individual if you're employed by somebody.
So, I mean, you've been a boss. You've been, sorry?
I said that's sad in my mind.
Yeah, it's like the over-PCification of life, in a sense. And you see areas where there's strides to kind of come back from that in the media world, I think. I actually think this whole Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien thing has been, in some ways, a pushback on some of the rules we place on ourselves just in terms of the way we push or pull or communicate with one another, you know, just in the way that sort of Jay Leno was, you know, attacked face-to-face, really, or via satellite by Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, it may be a little thing, and it's a media blip, and we're talking about heavy societal issues and how they're dealt with on the internet, but there's definitely an interplay between offline and online and how those two things start to get us thinking, you know, in your words, anthropologically wiring us, or, you know, just sociologically thinking about things in a particular way. So I'm hoping, I agree with you, I hope that we see less fear. But one question I ask you,
I want to bring, you know, comment on the Kimmel, you know, Conan O'Brien, Leno mess.
Oh yeah, go for it.
But just as an example of something that is a trend, in fact, I'm working on a post on this. I haven't finished it. But it's not just, you know, the spillover of the Leno O'Brien mess and the you know, the revealing of all the private arguments that were all being pushed out into the public. It's not just them. This is a trend that's happening increasingly across the world of business. In fact, there was a piece in the New York Times that got me thinking about this, that talked about Time Warner Cable was having a dispute with the News Corporation, and instead of just having it as a quiet backroom fight, they mounted a public campaign. They hired a political consultant to mount a political campaign to bring this out and to attempt to arouse public support for their stance in this business fight, right? And it's interesting that you know, this is a new trend in business, you know, to use public opinion in a way that's similar to political campaigns, but to do it as a way of revealing what's going on in these business deals, so that a company might be afraid that their stock price will drop if they don't come up with a more equitable deal with something, or might lose clients. You know, people aren't going to buy their tires or their toothpaste if they found out how they were, you know, messing with some supplier in their supply chain or something. And I think that's really an interesting thing because it suggests something about the power of publicity. In other words, to the extent that people do, or businesses increasingly do what they do in the open, right, then because it's in the open, other people are involved and they hear the argument. It's like a man and a wife having a domestic argument, but instead of having their kitchen, they go out in the street so all their neighbors can help, you know, or take sides or whatever. And so I think there's something fascinating there. There's a bunch of these examples I think are interesting. Well, the Conan O'Brien Leno thing, Scripps Network recruited a bunch of people from the Food Network, and then they complained in ads. I mean, so in the past there was a convention that's these business dealings weren't done in public and you're supposed to shut up about it. But now the people see it as a possible way of gaining leverage, you know, in negotiations. So, you know, whether it's legitimate or not, people are going to start doing it, and then it becomes a part of the fabric of how business is conducted. And so we'll see.
You know, it's funny because, you know, having been a journalist for a number of years, you know, we've talked about the court of public opinion versus the actual court and the, you know, the people who are deciding people's fate at trial or situation or whatever. And it's like this whole court of public opinion has taken on kind of its own life, if you will. In the examples that you use, you know, it's really, you know, things that may not have even, you know, aren't even court cases are taken to the public as something to be, you know, basically decided on, you know, and kind of there's this expectation that people should have an opinion about things that ordinarily they wouldn't even be involved in, as you noted.
Right, that's true. I mean, right. People wouldn't know what was going on. They wouldn't know there was a dispute unless they were privy to it because they worked in the business or something. So I think it is an indicator of a new climate, if you will, or a new set of rules that are intruding into the world of business, or even in things. Well, we've seen this in the past where various activist organizations rally people's support and raise money or whatever. But the same thing can be done when a business interaction, a scuffle between two or more business parties, in a sense, they're treating it as as much a part of society, although formally hidden, as things like the Audubon Society or, you know, Greenpeace. Mm-hmm. But the Greenpeace thing has always sort of been out in the open, to the extent that, it was in the interest of the activists to make it, you know, clear what the problems were. So it's kind of fascinating. I think it's just another example of the way that these tools can have an erosionary impact on old ways of doing things. They slowly get worn down or covered up by these new ways of interacting, and so they will kind of supersede our premises about privacy.
Yeah, I think it's a completely fascinating area, and I think one of the things that's most interesting as I sit here chatting with you is that, you know, you've been a boss, you've been, you know, at the top, you know, you've been the president of a company and an SVP of engineering, and you have a master's in computer science, yet you have this obvious affinity for, the more sociological or anthropological side of the web and the things that all of us are doing. Where do you think that comes from?
I think before I was, you know, a master's in computer science and a boss and all those other things, I was, you know, I had the heart of a philosopher or whatever from the beginning. And, you know, the things that first interested me prior to getting involved in computers were, you know, much more of the soft sciences. You know, I studied linguistics and anthropology and all those sorts of things. And it was actually in the last course I took in my senior year of my bachelor degree was a graduate seminar in linguistics, mathematical linguistics. I've always been strong in math. And I took that class, and I was introduced then to computer languages. I learned how to program Lisp, of all things. And it was really transformational. But, you know, when I went into computers and studied them, my interest was always related to my grounding in linguistics. So I got involved in programming language theory, and I worked in that part of computer science, you know, compilers and programming language tools. And in particular, my interest was in software tools, which is the tools that we build for programmers to collaborate around developing software. And you may recall that in the old days, you know, programmers were the first people who were wired. We were the first people who were connected in networks together working on software. We built that stuff for ourselves. And so I did that for, you know, 10, 12, 14 years. And I was interested in the collaborative side of it, you know, how people interact and share things just as much or maybe more so than, you know, the computer aspects of it. And so after I was president of a tiny little software company, I went through a merger, and I had the opportunity to jump out and do something else after being acquired by a publicly traded company. And I decided I was interested in this collaboration stuff, but how it was impacting, you know, regular people, not just programmers. And so starting in 1994, 95, I basically became what I am now, although I was much younger then. But I've basically been pursuing that ever since, you know, and wondering about how software of this art was going to, you know, change people, society, business, whatever. It wasn't until the end of the 90s that I hit on the what I think was the most interesting dimension of that, which was the fact that it was allowing us to shape culture, you know, the social dimension of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people thought I was crazy then, but, you know, luckily things fell the right way, and now I look like I was onto something.
Yeah, you were definitely ahead of your time, and you've been proven true in lots of different ways. I wonder. Pardon?
At least this one time. I don't talk about
all
the things.
At least this one time. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, so with all of the different projects that you've worked on, and, you know, those of us, none of us can stop the clock, so the years go on. But what do you feel is the So it's kind of it's just like a larger, I guess, philosophical question, which is, what is the largest impact you think you've had in sort of the web space, in the areas that you've worked and concentrated and focused? You're obviously a very in-demand speaker. People see your accomplishments. I think, you know, different people come to see someone like you with lots of different accomplishments from different perspectives. So I'd like to know from you what you think you know, your sort of greatest accomplishment is or the largest impact that you've had?
Well, you know, unlike a lot of people that you've probably had on the show, I'm not well-known primarily because I was some crackerjack entrepreneur, although I, you know, was president of a bunch of little companies and, you know, sold them all off and made money on most of them and so on. But that's not why I'm well-known. People don't say, Stowe Boyd, you know, captain of industry. That's not what they think. Primarily, I'd say looking back, I'm not certainly not, you know, ready to hang it up and, you know, get put under the ground. But looking back,
you better not be.
Looking back from where I am today, I'd say the biggest impact I've had is my writing. So, my biggest contribution is what I've been doing on, you know, blogs and various columns and so on. I've written in the past, for old school magazines. But nowadays, it's principally the writing I do at Message. So, you know, I've advanced a lot of ideas, and some of them have, you know, caught hold. And social tools is a good example. Microsyntax is another good example. Mm-hmm. Or most recently, this notion of publicity. So the idea that, this notion that there's something else that's coming to displace, you know, privacy as being the primary consideration around people's interaction on the web. And actually, for the first time today, I was reading an article that somebody had sent me a link to, and it used the term publicity without defining it.
Oh, wow.
Well, everyone obviously knows what this means. And that was kind of he quoted me later in the article, right? You know, but But it was interesting that, you know, it was just being used as the complement to privacy, as if everyone would obviously know. And that was kind of striking because I only coined the term, you know, 6 weeks ago or something. So, you know, the world wags really fast, and, you know, these kinds of helpful insights sometimes really do catch hold. So we'll see. I think, you know, my endless drone about the impact of social tools on the individual, society, media, and business, you know, adds up to something. And what I haven't done in the past is, like, put it in the form of a book, but actually one thing I'm doing this year as part of this conference is we're putting a book together called Social Business Book One, you know, with the contributions of the various people that are coming to the conference. And I think it'll be interesting, and hopefully we'll do more of them. So maybe that'll be the final most important contribution I make. Who knows? But it's definitely the writing side.
That's fantastic, because I wouldn't have guessed that necessarily. You know, it's not the most obvious answer. But it's definitely a way of sharing. And obviously collaboration and sharing is a huge part of what you consider important, it seems.
Well, yeah, a lot of the work I've done in the background with software startups, for example, people don't know about it. It's very quiet. And, you know, I'm an advisor to this company and that company, and I have an impact on those companies in various ways, and sometimes it's very consequential and sometimes it's, you know, subtle. But it's certainly not something that would be easy for someone to out there to pull all those threads together and say, gee, look at the great contribution Stowe's had, because he's worked with, I don't know, FreshBooks and Bitly and, you know, iMeme and so on over the past 10 years. How would they know? Nobody would even know I had worked with them.
Well, we might know from looking at your bio, but other than that, we wouldn't know. But
I think
one of the cool things is, you know, people call you a futurist. And, you know, to me what that means, and correct me if you think there's sort of a different definition around that. I mean, I'm sure there's a clinical real definition of what it is, but I think the working definition is you have a really good instinct for knowing or being able to define what the future holds or trends happening now that will evolve into a thing. So social tools being one of them, publicity being another that seems to have transpired pretty quickly. How did you define that word and, you know, why do you think it applies to you?
Well, I mean, I think generally it just means anybody who sort of speculates about where the world's going. But, you know, I like to think about it a little more structurally and say that, you know, productive futurists, people that really help, are ones that help other people think systematically about the future. So it's not so much that you define the future like an oracle does. This is the way it's going to be. And certainly, to some extent, you know, people like me do that sort of. We say, you know, this is the year of, you know, the decade of this or that. But the reason that, for example, I wrote the piece about the decade of publicity is I think that people need to start thinking about it and not just have it sneak up. And so, you know, I'm offering insights and thoughts to help people reason about it, right? And so that, you know, they're not blindsided by the future. And, you know, the only one that can help people deal with the future is themselves. I mean, they can't do what I tell them to do. They have their own future to live. Or a business has its own future to plot, you know, as a strategic plan. And so, you know, for example, in my dealings with, you know, large corporations, they'll have me come in and wave my hands, but my goal isn't, you know, to give them a stimulating, you know, inspiring speech. It's really to stretch their thinking and have them, as a result, walk away with better tools to think about the future themselves.
Mm-hmm. So who do you think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that would be a good way to value whether or not one futurist or another is a better futurist. You know, do they actually help people do that?
Yeah, and I was going to kind of take that a step further because I think that there are a number of people that have, you know, high-profile names like yourself who, you know, you could kind of lump into the category of futurist, some more so than others. One of the things I like about your approach is that you are really collaborative. I mean, I think that, you know, you do talk to others in the community. And so as a result, I think you have a pretty good sense of kind of who else has a really good instinct, because I think instinct is a lot of this. It's not just working with the tools and listening to others, but it's part of it's just kind of the gut. And I'm curious who else you either talk to or sort of ideas around with that you think are really kind of think innovatively in the sense that they are futurists themselves in the way you just defined.
Well, there's one guy that stands out for me because I talk to him all the time. He's a real close personal friend, but he's also considered one of the leading strategic thinkers about the nature of the future and so on. And that's Jaime Casio. I mean, he's a very brilliant guy. Works with the Institute of the Future. Does a lot of the work on their 10-year forecast, for example. Has his own business, helping people deal with the future, basically. And he's also a great writer. But there are others. I mean, other people that you would not think necessarily in that sense. I mean, I think Bruce Sterling is a fascinating guy. He's primarily a science fiction writer. But he's also the guy that's dreamed up all kinds of things that that are coming true in the world. He's the one that coined the term spimes, the notion that machines would be updating their presence to the world. It's kind of an amazing idea, and now it's coming true. So your plant will Twitter you that it's time to pour water on it, for example. So, I mean, there's some people like that. Well, science fiction writers, you'd think, would be in that ordinary way. But there's also, really great minds who are, working in the world of consulting or inside of companies that are really brilliant. And there's a lot of them. There's a lot of, there's a lot of really smart people out there. But, those two are ones that I talk to relatively frequently.
That's very cool. And you're based on the East Coast, is that right?
That's right. I had my base of operations in San Francisco for the last few years, but this year, just last fall, actually, I relocated my base to New York City, although my family lives here in Reston, Virginia, where I am today. But I'm working in offices now in New York City.
So I was just curious how that, especially with the recent change, how you feel that may influence or if the perspectives of others seem different from one coast to the other.
Well, yeah, there are differences. They're not quite as great as the difference between, say, London to the United States or London to New York. But there really is a difference between, West Coast and East Coast approaches to things. Not necessarily one's better than the other, but I'm an East Coast guy, so it seems more natural for me to be on the East Coast, although I enjoyed my time in San Francisco. My primary motivation, though, to move to New York is just that the tech scene is going nuts there right now, and I'm fascinated with the fact that there's so many interesting tech startups, and there seems to be a real renaissance going on there, whereas right now, from my viewpoint, San Francisco is sort of, licking its wounds from the last couple of downturns, and has a certain, I wouldn't say defeatist characteristic. I mean, there's still a lot of great stuff going on there, but, right now New York City is just off the hook with startups. It's just really phenomenal.
I know what you mean, because for me, being in the Silicon Valley, and I've lived in New York City and did my master's at Columbia, it's definitely, there is a definite licking of wounds, and I worry actually and think a lot about, is enough innovation happening here to keep the spotlight or focus on this area? And I do apologize for the additional noise in the room, but I think that that's a fascinating piece that you've hit on there, because I find that to be true myself.
Yeah, I am starting an interview series this month, in February, actually. I'm interviewing people in the New York tech scene to try to sort of get at what's going on there.
Fantastic. So we'll have to look for that. Do you have a specific kickoff date that you know you're going to start with, or a person that you want to talk about?
I don't, because my schedule just changed. I thought I was going to New York this week for, a speaking engagement that didn't come together, and so as a result, I went along with some other opportunity. So I won't be in New York City this week after all. Otherwise, I would have started this week, but it'll be soon.
Well, that's great. We'll have to look for that from you. So I want to thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
It's flown by, and I hope you'll keep in touch as you launch other products and we can let the audience know about them and your unique perspective.
Yeah, great. And the conference, I think, in April, the Social Business Edge Conference will be.
Absolutely. And you can't forget, with Jeff Holder at your side, you will be well served.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
All right. You take care. I will let you go. That was Stowe Boyd, and I want to thank all of you who've tuned in to listen to Stowe and myself here on the A-List. Remember to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. Again, I apologize for this voice in the background. I am at the Women in Periodical Publishing Conference in San Francisco. Be sure to tune in next week when famed cellist Zoe Keating is my featured guest. That's 1 week from today, starting at noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and other free information at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a fabulous weekend.